Welcome to Lawyering Up. We have a special episode. We have officially run out of guests to have on our show, so it's just Eddie and I. You have the benefit of two attorneys. We really wanted to delve into a topic, and when we were putting our show together, we had talked about the hot topics in the law, and certainly topics that we think our listeners can benefit from learning a little bit about, and we get the chance to learn a little bit about those things, both in our practice and preparing to talk about them today. So today's episode is about the Me Too movement, the Harvey Weinstein trial, a little bit about the Bill Cosby trial, and what that means to civil and criminal practitioners of the law and people in general, in the workplace, in life in general. So this is a very important topic. Ed and I have had some experience with this topic on behalf of clients, on behalf of victims, and we are looking forward to getting into it and learning more together about the Me Too movement, Harvey Weinstein's case, and where we go from here.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big week. We ran out of guests. Either that says something about me and you, or and we ran out of co-hosts today
too. Our
problem
is our schedules. You know? We can never pin down our schedules. We have a host of guests coming
we
up.
We do.
I can tell you
we
that.
Do. But Jared, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about right off the get go is, speaking of Harvey Weinstein, it's such a unique case. It was a rape case. It was a sexual predator case. No physical evidence. From a prosecutor's standpoint, how hard of a case is that where you have no physical evidence whatsoever? It is only testimony. It is only circumstantial evidence. When you approach a case like that, how does that make you feel as a prosecutor? Say, well, knowing that you're not going to have a DNA kit. You're not going to have a rape kit. You're not going to have a photograph of bruising or anything like that in order to show the jury. What does that do to your preparation as a prosecutor bringing a case like that to trial?
I think the big question first is it's certainly a challenge. Oftentimes we love to have admissions. We really like to have DNA, but this isn't CSI. You know, oftentimes we are faced with what we call the typical he said, she said cases. And we're going to talk a little bit about these become he said, she said, and she said, and she said cases.
Right, right, right.
The Harvey Weinstein case is even tougher than that.
Yeah.
And if you look at the victims in Harvey Weinstein, Miriam Haley and Jessica Mann, they maintained a relationship, a consensual relationship with Harvey Weinstein beyond their sexual assault situation, which further complicates their cases.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. You know, having that evidence as a prosecutor, is that a case that you look at and you're like, geez, I don't know. I mean, I got some questions here. I don't know if this is one that we could really or should push forward or we could win.
Well, again, you do that assessment. There is a risk assessment involved because it is tough to put victims through that trial process.
Right,
so
right.
Yes, you have that conversation. This was an important case, and every sexual assault case is an important case. But what the Harvey Weinstein case now stands for is that sexual assault victims who maintain these kinds of relationships beyond the incident itself may have a voice in the criminal courtroom.
Right.
But the risk of winning or losing wasn't the biggest risk here. The risk here was what would losing the Harvey Weinstein case if these victims weren't believed due to the Me Too movement or the empowerment of women overall.
Or what would it have done to that movement not bringing the case? If the prosecutors made a decision, if they said, look, there's no physical evidence, that obviously is a real impediment to this case. One, there's no physical evidence. And secondly, you know, there's all these emails that talk about that they're having a consensual relationship at times, and they admitted to having consensual sex with Harvey Weinstein at times. If the prosecutors made a decision ultimately and said, you know what, we're just not going to move forward with this, what do you think that would have said to the Me Too movement and said overall to these types of cases?
I think a loss would have been worse and would have stifled the movement, because I think that there has been significant progress made in the movement in spite of whether or not the Harvey Weinstein case was sought. There have been high-profile filings. There have been civil claims pursued. There has been empowerment in women, and we say women in particular, and certainly in some cases of men in the LGBT community as well. There's been empowerment just by people finding a voice and the ability to speak.
Right.
So I think the movement has gotten legs no matter what. If the decision was made ultimately not to prosecute Harvey Weinstein, he certainly has been dethroned. He certainly has been publicly shamed. He is
there's
public enemy number one in Hollywood.
There's plenty of civil suits that are pending against him and his company and everything else as a result of this as well.
Despite his well-documented efforts to stifle anyone who stood against him in the press, personally, professionally. So what a loss would have done, I think, is I don't think Harvey Weinstein would have been vindicated in any way because I think the damage overall is done to him.
Yeah.
What a loss would have done was been a bad backlash on the Me Too movement. It could have stopped the movement.
Right.
It just would have disenfranchised the movement.
So let me ask you a couple of questions because, you know, obviously my practice is all civil. And one of the things that I remember from law school in the criminal sense is that normally prior bad acts of the individual are not allowed in because, you know, the jury's supposed to be judging this individual on whether they committed this crime, not all these other crimes. But that's not what we saw in the Weinstein case. You had all these other women who were not victims that were allowed to testify as to what Harvey Weinstein did to them over, and that obviously the defense strenuously objected. The judge ultimately ruled that this was permissible. How did that happen? Like how were those women allowed to testify and why?
I'll take you back. Before the Weinstein case, we had another case of a high profile celebrity in Bill Cosby's case. Bill Cosby had two trials actually in Montgomery County where trial number one, which I happen to see some of, there were no other victims that testified other than Andrea Constead. That jury hung. The same judge presiding over that trial allowed for some of the other victims to testify in the case. And I can tell you, I was there. There was a virtual parade of victims on the steps of the courthouse. So here's why those individuals were allowed to tell their story. And in the Weinstein case, because the facts and circumstances as to those victims were so similar that it creates a pattern, a signature crime. I always tell the story of, if you remember the Home Alone movies, the Wet Bandits. They used to leave the faucet running. Yeah. And then at the end of the movie, the officer says to Joe Pesci, we know which house you guys hit every time because you left the water on. Harvey Weinstein's crimes have a signature. He uses the pattern of, I'll get you a job. I'll further your career. He invites these women to his hotel room. He engages in a violent series of sexual acts.
Also nonviolent, though. I mean, it seems like it went between violence and then kindness and empathy and then trying to get him a job and then back to, you know, using his power and really playing a lot of mind games with these women.
Tremendous amount of manipulation.
Yeah, tremendous.
And why Annabella Sciorra was allowed to tell her story in particular. So the underlying victims were Miriam Haley and Jessica Mann. They were the two named victims in the case. And if you were to believe those two victims, which the jury did, then they were to consider the Annabella Sciorra evidence from the 1990s where he conducted himself in a very similar manner with her and raped her violently, as she claimed, then you would say this conduct fits a predatory pattern.
And that's what they found not guilty on, right?
And that particular crime carried a lifetime of imprisonment for Weinstein. So here's the balancing test you do. As a prosecutor, and I've done this, you take what we call in Pennsylvania 404B evidence, where the evidence is so similar, motive, opportunity, intent. There's no other conclusion you can reach than this is the actor and this is the person that did it. So you balance yourself. You try to draw all these similarities. You then take that evidence and fight the defense in front of the judge to try and get that evidence in. It's very difficult to do because, you know, the goal is to not prejudice a defendant.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is you can rob 10 banks, but when you go on trial for one bank robbery, you may not know, the jury may not know that that individual robbed 9 other banks.
Right.
So it is a heightened level of consideration the judges and the courts give to that evidence. But I can tell you it's powerful evidence.
Well, how could it not? I mean, how could it not be? You know, when you take a step back and you look at it and you say, man, you got 30 people that are testifying essentially to the same thing, how does a jury not reach the conclusion that the guy did it? I mean, it I think it's so impactful and so powerful. And from a, I don't say a fairness standpoint, but from a purely legal standpoint, does that really upset the apple cart in favor of the prosecution over the defense all the time? The more people that you're going to be bringing in there, it's almost overwhelming.
Well, so if you look at the numbers, like Harvey Weinstein by the numbers has 80 accusers, okay, and a very limited amount of evidence came in the underlying trial. Yeah. Bill Cosby had
hundreds, right?
Yeah, I think he had several dozens and dozens of accusers. I believe five was the number that came in. So as a prosecutor, you have to consider appeal issues and you don't want to be overturned. So you have to find those instances that are so similar, that kind of line up on all fours, that it is compelling. It's certainly it's prejudicial, okay, but not
is it
too,
overly prejudicial? Right, yeah.
Right, but you're right to think, I mean, yes, does that make your case a slam dunk? No, here's why.
Yeah.
Because those individuals are going to be cross-examined. Those individuals, oftentimes, maybe you don't have as compelling of a case of evidence with those individuals that case doesn't even need to have been brought.
And I want to stop you there for a minute because you mentioned cross-examination. And I read an account or listened to a podcast about one of the cross-examinations of the one victim literally had a panic attack.
Jessica Mann was cross-examined brutally by Donna Rotunno, who Donna Rotunno is defense counsel for Harvey Weinstein and has kind of become the spokesperson on behalf of, she's represented a lot of men accused, high-profile men accused, maybe involuntarily has become the spokesperson for the defense of these kinds of claims. She cross-examined Jessica Mann extensively. Jessica Mann then needed a break in the trial and in front of the jury broke down and was said to have a panic attack, which that's another thing. So many of these cases go unreported. You know, the World Health Organization did a study and Washington Post did a study. One third of women may have been sexually assaulted. And we're not talking necessarily rape, but may have been a victim of a sexual assault. They believe 95% of those cases or individuals responsible go unpunished. The question is, why is that happening? Because number one, there's some self-blame that goes on. There's really a chilling effect of
the
embarrassment.
Trauma. I mean,
there's trauma.
They don't want to relive the trauma.
But the other side of it is, no one voluntarily chooses to subject themselves to that kind of cross-examination. Now, preparation, empowerment, the Me Too movement has allowed for, and there is certainly empowerment in others. I've been involved in cases where victims come forward after one or two claims come out. And then it's just an effect. It's a phenomenon you see in these cases. Someone comes forward. Next thing you know, there's five or six accusers.
Yeah.
Because there is empowerment in numbers.
Oh, no question.
So if the Me Too movement has done, one of the significant things it's done is it's given women in particular a voice in these kinds of claims.
And the other thing interesting that it's done, Jared, and I do a lot of work with people who have traumatic brain injuries. And we work a lot with neuroscientists and we do a lot of work in the area of memory. And I thought one of the really interesting things in the Weinstein trial, and I think it was Dr. Ziv, was talking – Dr. Ziv, right?
Yes, Dr. Barbara Ziv.
She was talking about imperfect memory and how the defense always wants to say, well, they didn't remember what they were wearing. They didn't remember, what they ate that day. They didn't remember what time it was. They didn't remember what – this shows that they're lying. And I thought Dr. Ziv, it was really fascinating because the neuroscience supports this. It's like actually it supports that they're telling the truth because when you have a trauma like that, you're not sitting there saying, oh, he's wearing a blue shirt. You're looking, you're remembering the rage. You're remembering the violence. You're remembering things that are going to leave an impression in your frontal cortex, not – geez, he had, plaid socks on. So I thought that was really fascinating and really important in the context of these victims, how over the years, they always say, well, their story's changed six times. No, their story hasn't changed at all. It's that over 6 years, initially, they may have remembered the shirt was blue. 6 years later, they may say, it may be red.
Well, and I think those are the kind of things that Maya Angelou said, you don't remember necessarily what someone does or says. You remember how they make you feel. And Dr. Ziv, who that was part of her testimony. And she's someone I happen to know.
I thought it was
very bright person.
I thought it was fascinating.
She testified also about the counterintuitive behavior of some of the victims of the Harvey Weinstein case.
Explain that to our four listeners.
So,
it's a robust follow.
Yes. Yeah, so we know
it. Hakem, is listening
right now.
The Vinsko
family now.
Keith, Wendy, everybody.
So we hope. My understanding of the counterintuitive. So what happens is people want to write off counterintuitive behavior.
Explain what that means.
So basically, we have, as you said, Jessica Mann and Miriam Haley continued on in consensual relationships with Harvey Weinstein.
I mean, they're sending emails to the guy. They're sending emails, love.
Ed, they had consensual relations with him.
Yeah.
However, Dr. Ziv explained that there is a bit of regaining power, trying to compartmentalize what happened. It's part of the manipulation. If you're a victim of manipulation, you are going to act in a way prescribed by the manipulator. Right. And what she has testified to and is written extensively on is this is a phenomenon she has seen in victims. So one of the things I've learned after 16 years of being a prosecutor is sometimes you cannot apply logic to an illogical situation.
Right.
You may look at counterintuitive behavior. You have to become a student at that point.
Right.
You have
to
be willing to learn that something may be causing
that. Isn't that part of the criminal mind then of Harvey Weinstein or individuals like Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby is that they kind of move these women into almost thinking that it is consensual. It is okay. This is fine. What we're doing is okay. And it almost becomes part of exactly what he wants them to do, that he takes it from this, you know, really kind of violent, non-consensual things and breaks them down to a point that now they're powerless.
That's exactly what he's doing. So there's that back alley random rape situation.
And that's not what we have here.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that is a far cry from really what you typically see.
Right.
Sexual assault victims are typically assaulted by someone they know, oftentimes someone in their family when it comes to children.
Yeah.
They don't understand in that moment that is necessarily wrong. They may grow to develop and understand that it was wrong. It may be in the confines of what they see as a consensual relationship. This is a complicated crime, and it really takes patience and understanding on the prosecution end and in the civil end to understand what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And that's part of what these cases has really brought to light. That's what the Me Too movement has brought to light. If you look at how it came about, Alyssa Milano, back in October of 2017, in a tweet, encouraged people, if you've been sexually assaulted, share this Me Too hashtag.
Yeah.
It was shared 12 million times in 24 hours.
It's unbelievable.
Do you think people want to admit that they were the victim of a horrible crime? That
no,
they were...
I think that we're learning more about it. And that's why I think that, you know, getting back to the beginning, when I asked about bringing this case into a courtroom, I think it was so much more than just winning the case. The symbolic nature of just getting it into a courtroom, knowing that the prosecution, one, you don't have to have a perfect victim. Matter of fact, you're not going to have a perfect
victim. You never have a perfect victim. I can
and
tell you that.
They're not going to have perfect memory. They're going to have counterintuitive behavior, but that doesn't mean they're lying. And it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And it doesn't mean that somebody like Harvey Weinstein is not a criminal. And even though he wasn't convicted of being the predatory nature, you know, of it, I think that, you know, the court of public opinion, everybody probably agrees that he is guilty of that aspect.
And it's a game changer, I think, for prosecutors. And prosecutors, wide ranging, were watching this with great interest.
Right.
Because typically in the past, when prosecutors have seen this continuing relationship, they've elected not to go forward.
Or lack of DNA or lack of physical evidence. They've said...
And of all cases, to do it in the Weinstein case,
you know,
there was a tremendous amount of risk. But I believe that this is a game changer, that cases like this are going to get greater consideration and will likely be pursued based on a renewed or a new understanding of this phenomenon and the testimony of people like Dr. Ziv. The other thing is, too, is what have we learned since then? You know, we have been part of cases pursuing the church. We've been part of cases with Boy Scouts of America. what have we learned? What does it mean for guys? You know, we're two guys talking about the Me Too movement. What does it mean? And for the listeners that we have out there, the guy listeners that we have out there, you need to pay attention to this. And I think, first of all, what have we learned? You have to listen to the stories of these victims. Listen how they have been treated. Listen to the conduct that is now being seen, and obviously sexual assault is one thing.
Right.
But the kind of discussions and the kind of things that are no longer welcomed in the workplace.
Well, and you hit on a good point, Jared, because especially with regard to the church and the Boy Scouts, there is a grooming that goes on in those institutions. And they
manipulation, they, just like Weinstein.
They manipulate and they groom young men and women to think that this behavior is okay. And so, you know, in those aspects, I think that now we recognize what that behavior looks like a lot more than we did even 5 years ago. So now I think that from a perspective of looking at what goes on, you can see it. You can see it more apparently. And if you see it, then you know what? You have an obligation to do something about it.
And guys have to call out demeaning behavior. This is not body locker room talk. No. I love that. Like, I mean, you have to call it out.
It just has to stop, because when it happens once and nobody says anything, then the next time it gets a little bit more aggressive and nobody says anything, then it gets a little bit more aggressive. And each time that breaks down that particular individual's defenses. And the more their defenses are broken down, that is exactly what the whole Me Too movement is about. That women, and even men in some, you know, respects, but obviously, you know, the overwhelming amount of individuals that have been affected by the Me Too movement are women. They just feel powerless.
Well, and you know, it hasn't been without its criticism either. There are people that say the Me Too movement is bad for women. It promotes victimhood.
That was the whole defense in Harvey Weinstein. You know, I mean, one of the things that she kept banging, like, how can a woman not know what's going to happen when she goes to Harvey Weinstein's hotel room at 2 o'clock in the morning?
But don't you agree? I think there is a lot of responsibility that for men to start calling out this behavior and to comport their behavior to professionalism.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, women and the Me Too movement may have helped some of this need to become much more aware and avoid
certain,
these kind of
things. No question.
But, you know, if you're an aspiring actress or an aspiring model, which you could have been any of those things, Eddie.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Hand model. I could have been a hand or foot model.
You take a person like Harvey Weinstein, who was king of the volcano in Hollywood, and a young, impressionable model. This guy has so much power over this individual.
He's a king and queen maker, no question.
But people need to be aware that, you know, monsters wear a lot of different clothes, including captains of industry.
Sure.
So we've seen it in the military, in government, in all aspects of business.
Well, I mean, you know, just talking about the church cases, I mean, you have your priest who now is paying really special attention to you. And this is somebody that you look up to and you care deeply about. And, you know, there's faith that's involved. And now all of a sudden, when they say, geez, why don't you come back to the rectory? Well, before, nobody would ever say, geez, don't do it. Now everybody says, you would never do it. You would never.
But
you would
why?
Never put,
they say it now because of the awareness.
Exactly.
You know, and they. So the thing is, what are we learning? Where do we go from here? You know, there's the development of what they call whisper networks, and the Weinstein effect essentially is that women, typically women, are becoming more aware and maintaining just a network to say, avoid this person, stay away from this person.
Right.
Aware. You know, we had a dog in our neighborhood that bit one of the kids when we were kids. We had. Neighborhoods were different then. You had a lot of kids. It wasn't that long ago, but one.
I didn't get that case.
No, but like everybody knew to stay away from the bite or dog, you know. And if those whisper networks, and I think that's a bad name for them, but that's what they're known as. Awareness is key. Where Weinstein preyed on power, priests have preyed on power and trust.
But here's the thing about Weinstein. What's the common link between if you have Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, the church, and the Boy Scouts? What's the common thread through all of those? At some point, they're all of Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, priest, Boy Scout leaders, They're all part of an institution.
Jerry Sandusky.
Too. Jerry Sandusky. They were all part of some larger institution. And that's where I think that now, from an institutional standpoint, there is more institutional awareness, or should be, because certainly there were everybody knew. I mean, people in Harvey Weinstein's atmosphere, they had to know what was going on.
I mean, if you educate yourself about the manner in which he conducted himself, he would just hold meetings in the nude. You're just like, what in the blue hell is going on?
Honestly, God. And they turned a blind eye to it.
Right.
The institutions turned a blind eye to it because he was making the money. Penn State turned a blind eye to Jerry Sandusky because Penn State football made money. I mean, let's be honest. The church has turned a blind eye, not only turned a blind eye to it, and they've all done a lot to cover it up because they want to keep power and influence and money. Same with the Boy Scouts, same with everything else. So at its core, there's just a systemic institutional problem of turning a blind eye to people who are providing money to these institutions.
There needs to be, and if there's anything that can be learned from the institutional level, and in academia, in business and in government, there needs to be policies and reporting networks in place that have actual teeth here.
Right.
And consequences.
Yep. And no recourse to the person reporting.
Right.
That's what
people... Well, let's talk about reporting, too. One of the criticisms, they talk about false reporting.
Right.
And if you look, and the literature says that very few claims are falsely reported,
right,
but it happens, and they're highly publicized when they do.
And I heard Donna Rotunno, is that her
name?
I heard her say a million times, those poor Duke lacrosse kids, this has scarred them for life. That's the only one I heard her say. So, I mean, you know, yeah, are there false reporting claims? Sure, there's false reporting claims. But every time she's asked about, well, you know, she was asked and interviewed, she cited one example. Not 100 examples.
Well, and that's the thing.
One example.
There are falsely accused of murder on occasion. It doesn't mean they don't commit the crime,
right,
and that there aren't people that are guilty.
Right.
So you need, and I think that we're getting away from that.
Yeah.
I think we really are. But really, to see change and some good has to come out of what we're learning. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said these institutions have to wise up. They have to wise up from a civil standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have brought claims against these very institutions.
No question.
And receive compensation for clients.
Yep.
The other thing is the NDAs and those kind of things. It's made its way into how about every
well,
president?
How about Bloomberg?
That's
right
what I was
now.
Just going to say.
I mean, when you talk about institution, there's not a bigger and more powerful institutional, you know, Bloomberg, and there's sexual harassment going on in his institution.
Donald.
And he doesn't want to even know about it.
President Trump, President Clinton, Michael Bloomberg. These individuals have all been accused of sexual misconduct by one form or another, okay? It has found its way into every aspect of our experience. And it's so prevalent in society that we have to learn from an institutional level to build better policies, build better reporting networks, and recognize that this is happening.
Well, there has to be, on the institutional level, there also has to be more education. You know, and when I say education meaning this is what you need to do whenever you have a situation like this. People need to understand there's a process. For example, the women in the Harvey Weinstein case, if they knew that there was a process in place at these film studios where if somebody, even if it was Harvey Weinstein, was making unwarranted sexual advances to them, they could do A, B, and C. That's different. There was nothing in place. They had no place to.
Well, in fact, they believed if they brought it out that he would ruin their careers. And,
exactly.
And there are individuals who are quite famous in Hollywood have come out and said they believe. It was Ashley Judd, or one of them believed. She believed she lost out on a part in the Lord of the Rings series because Weinstein had essentially blacklisted her when she rebuffed his sexual advances. So that's the kind of stuff that there is going to be a substantial consequence that we've seen on the civil end to these institutions. But, you know, evil prevails when good people do nothing. And, you know, you take a guy like Sandusky. Here's a monster, okay, a monster predator. And a scorpion will always be a scorpion.
Yeah.
But when the good people who are the quote-unquote people who weren't doing anything wrong don't call that out, to me, that's an even greater evil.
Well, now,
there's a special place in hell for people that sit by and don't report that.
Sure, because now they're allowing it. I mean, they're giving, you know, it's just like fire. The only way fire is going to grow is you got to feed it oxygen. They're giving oxygen to that fire. Right. They're enabling it to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it gets so big they can't put it out. Now we're seeing, you know, with the Boy Scouts and now the, you know, the church, are there wonderful, wonderful, you know, people in Boy Scouts? Sure. Are there wonderful priests? Sure. But there's also this massive institutional problem that they did nothing about for many years.
And now where are they? They're bankrupt. The Boy Scouts have declared bankruptcy. Yep. The diocese, Harrisburg Diocese, has since declared bankruptcy. Scranton may be heading there.
So, I mean, it's weird. And now you got, you know, countless civil suits against Weinstein. Bill Cosby's in jail pretty much for the rest of his life. So, you know, where does it end? And I don't know. I mean, you hope that we're starting to see maybe a little bit of a cultural change, cultural shift. But every time you think you see a little bit of a cultural shift, another shoe drops.
But, and think about this, too. And this, the name of our show is Lawyering Up. I mean, let's talk about the role of lawyers in this whole thing, okay? Donna Rotunno, in a sense, was somebody that defended Harvey Weinstein and did her job. But
hey, I mean, and this will be, you know, super controversial, but I applaud her for doing her job.
Right.
Harvey Weinstein.
But who brought it out? Look, the women of the Me Too movement have given it a voice, but lawyers, by and large, have, through the civil claims, through the prosecutions, have given this movement, have given victims a voice time and time again. And lawyers often get a bad rap, some self-inflicted. But the reality is, if you did not have the ability to pursue these individuals, these institutions, through the courts, through the guidance of your attorney, oftentimes these things come out in discovery and through the lawsuits.
And I want to go back to Weinstein's lawyer for a minute. When I say I applaud her for doing her job, I applaud her for doing her job because nobody can say that Harvey Weinstein didn't have somebody on his side who was going after, you know, these women with both barrels. He can't sit back and say, my lawyer wasn't prepared. He can't sit back and say,
He'll try. He's filed an appeal already.
Oh, right. But I mean, that's, Joe, that's where I say, look, when I'm on the other side, bring it all on. Because at the end of the day, you know from a prosecution standpoint, at the end of the day, when the jury decides it in your favor, you want to know that the other side, they did everything possible to make that go the other way, and they still didn't believe it. And I think that's where, you know, I think that I'm very happy that this, you know, this woman came in, she had a team with her, and I mean, they absolutely did everything possible to win that case. They didn't do it. But Harvey Weinstein and the people who are, I would say, Harvey Weinstein sympathizers can't sit back now and say, geez, he didn't get a fair shake. They will, but when you look at the trial, they're not going to be able to do that.
If you look back, first of all, that's an important point, I think, that he did have every defense, you know, every weapon available to him. But before he got there, I mean, he employed powerful figures in the media.
Yeah.
He employed Attorney Bloom, who's Gloria Allred's daughter, early on. He was, if you look at Ronan Farrow and the folks that, Megan Towie, I believe it was, who tried to bring these stories to light.
No doubt.
NBC backed off. The New Yorker originally gave pushback. All of these major institutions, they were afraid.
The New York Times was the only one that ultimately stuck with it.
Right. And when it finally came out, so Harvey Weinstein had employed defense mechanisms and had a machine in place early on to silence any victims. So I think that, you know, he's had every possible outlet available to him to protect himself, more than certainly an average person would have. But the lesson to be learned here is this, and as a prosecutor and as civil lawyers, if you believe you have been the victim or someone you love has been the victim of sexual assault, sexual abuse, harassment in the workplace, that conduct needs to be consequenced.
Yeah.
It needs to be reported, and certainly we can help you find your voice.
And it needs to stop. I mean, it just absolutely, everybody needs to be more cognizant of it. Everybody needs to really pay attention more. I mean, especially you saw how devastated these women were and how they relived this all the time. That's the thing that I thought when I heard some of the testimony, watched some of the interviews, you could see it. I mean, these women aren't lying. I mean, they're wearing this. They're, 80% of what you say is body language, and you watch their body language, and you can't, it's hard to fake body language. I mean, it is. You watch their body language. I mean, they are in physical agony.
Look at Weinstein's body language now. Yeah. He's destroyed.
He's shot.
He's been the dethroned king of the volcano, yeah, essentially, and he's broken. And right now, as we're taping, he's in a mental institution, not even in jail yet, because he is experiencing certain mental health crises that have kept him out of jail. But eventually, he's got a date with a jail cell and a long sentence.
Yeah, and he's not a young man, so he's going to be likely looking at the rest of his life in jail. And Cosby's done, and Sandusky's never getting out of jail as well. So
the end result is we've seen high profile victory on behalf of the women and children that we've seen abused. Overall. And that is hopeful that we're learning. And we just hope that beyond financial recovery we can find for people, beyond jailing the perpetrators, that overall there is an effect and people learn that you cannot conduct yourself.
Look at this. We talked to each other for almost 45 minutes today.
I'm going to send you a bill for this
I'm telling you, this was pretty good. This was not bad for not having a guest today. Well, Jared, this has been a lot of fun. I think it was a really important topic that we needed to tackle today, especially very timely, being that, Weinstein's trial just concluded this week. And a lot of people, I don't know if they really understood the nuances of it, just how complicated a trial it was. And so thank you for, being able to explain some of that stuff. I think it was really, really important and interesting. As always, I had a blast.
And I think these things are going to continue to develop. So we'll cover them as as we see fit.
Yeah.
So thanks so much to our listeners out there. And we'll be back with a host of guests, too. We have some people wanting to come on.
The show's
starting to get some legs. Oh. I love when people come up and say, hey, I listened to your podcast. So it's great. Keep listening and certainly rate us, only if you're rating us good, though.
That's right. It's a small but robust following right now. And it's growing. It's growing by leaps and bounds.
That's right. Thanks so much, Eddie.
We're like a rash.
That's right. Thanks.
All right.